Welcome to another Trench Chat, and I'm really pleased to welcome back Professor Peter Doyle, a great friend of this podcast who supported it in the early stages when we began broadcasting episodes, and a great friend of mine as well, who I've known for many, many years, geologist, historian, author. He's been on numerous television programs, numerous podcasts, and I've also had the pleasure to work with him on quite a few archaeology projects as well. So welcome back, Peter. Great to see you.
Great to be back. Thanks, Paul.
So I kind of saw on Twitter that you were delivering a paper at a conference on mine craters on the Somme, and that immediately kind of piqued my interest because this podcast, a big chunk of it, is about landscape and how that fits into the story and understanding of the First World War. So I guess really kind of where did that start for you, and I guess we'll discuss where that's led you.
Well, I think you'll know where it started, Paul. It probably started the same place as it did for you, in that anybody that goes to the Somme and gets to that huge hole in the ground, the Longnagaul crater, cannot fail to be impressed, horrified even, by the scale of it, by the devastation that it wrought, by the nature of the tussles, the battles, the individual tragedies and successes of the men who got to that point. So that is absolutely a major hole in the ground. And if you've been to look at any craters in other situations, I've been to Meteor Crater in Arizona. It's a big hole in the ground. It's created by a meteor. It's in a fairly dry part of the world, and yet it's a big hole in the ground. And yet I still couldn't help feeling, as I looked into that it was not as impressive as Longnagaul. So it all started with Longnagaul, and I think there's been a lot of work done on Longnagaul, a lot of interest with the rise and advent of the use of drones. You know, we're able to see it in all its glory and to try and get some sense of what's going on with it. My interest then started with it because I was working with a bunch of guys from a number of universities, Jamie Pringle and Chris Wisniewski from Keele University and others from Staffordshire University. And they were working with the Hawthorne Ridge Crater Association, looking at that, throwing many different pieces of quite heavyweight tech at this to see what it could characterize. And I thought, working with those guys, wouldn't it be great if we had a kind of view as a whole of all of these craters that were explicitly exploded on the 1st of July, and to look at them in their sort of cultural and historic significance? And it's that I really was keen on. So whilst the tech guys were keen on throwing their kit at it, I was thinking, wow, these are holes in the ground that were really significant. They've been in many artworks and many, you know, incredible accounts. We've got some really, as you know, very amazing viewpoints of how that thing exploded, you know, from the air, from the ground. So I really wanted to explore that. And that's what I've been doing. And that's what I presented in South Carolina. What they made of it, I'm not sure. But I started out by showing them a crater, the biggest one I've ever seen, which was in the Nevada nuclear test site. That is a hole in the ground. Even then, it's still too huge to imagine, and Longnagaul still holds in my head the best place.
And I guess these kind of mine craters have become symbolic of the First World War in that kind of alien landscape that we see depicted in imagery of the conflict. They're very much part of that story.
They are, and I think it's really interesting. Just this last weekend, I was in Flanders and Ypres Salient, and I went to see the Bluff Crater. I'd actually not seen the Bluff Crater before. And anybody who knows those craters, the Bluff, Caterpillar, and the ones in and around the Messines battlefield, some ways this is a sort of slight disappointment. Well, where's the hole in the ground? Why isn't it, you know, like a crater? Why isn't it like a meteor crater? And that's all down to the ground conditions, as we know, and very complex as it is in Flanders. But when you go to the Somme, it is the chalk soil and the principle of this thing exploding that soil out of the ground and leaving this great gaping wound. And it is therefore fascinating that those things are preserved, and particularly Longnagaul, preserved in this sort of entirety. But I was also struck by the fragility. If it hadn't have been for Richard Dunning, I think, who saved Longnagaul, if it hadn't have been for the work of the Hawthorne Beach Creature Association and others to actually work on Hawthorne, where would they be? Because there is that one missing crater, the one that you very kindly supplied a photograph of from your archives, YSAP. That was a huge crater, but that is, there's no record of it. So I was struck by, although these are incredible, huge holes in the ground, very, very dynamic looking with these sort of crater-like shapes that we get in on the Somme rather than the sort of rather fallen in areas that we get in Flanders. But they are fragile. If you can fill in a hole in the ground like YSAP, you could easily have filled in a hole in the ground like Loch na Gar. So it's an incredible piece of fragility.
No, that's an interesting point. I mean, I kind of remember going up onto the Red Ann Ridge, which was an area of much smaller mine craters, you know, from that kind of early period, some of them probably dating back to the French tussles with the Germans much earlier in the war. And now there's just a kind of slight dip where they were. There's no craters at all. And it does make you wonder what has been lost.
Yeah, and I think one of the interesting things, of course, is that if you go to some of the, you know, most famous mine activity, you know, you'll get used to seeing that. So even just going to Vimy Ridge, I mean, even just, you know, go to Vimy Ridge and you'll see those mine craters in no man's land, and you'll see the work of human beings to kind of create this devastation, but also to create maybe trenches and the like. The very crater I was talking about, the nuclear crater that was formed in Nevada, the plans they had there was to explode underground munitions to create a new canal. This is the kind of craziness that they were coming to. And so that's not a million miles away from what people were trying to do in creating you know, a set of trenches or defensive positions. And those are still there, but natural processes come into play, and those natural processes will mean gradual creep of the sides and slopes, gradual failure of those and infilling. And I think it is, that's why I was always struck by the difference between Loch na Gar and, of course, Hawthorne Ridge. And that all comes down to the nature of the soils of the Somme, which are largely misunderstood, as is often the case. You know, sometimes you're going to get quite thick soils, brownish, reddish soils that create the classic mud of the Somme kind of thing. And then you're going to get those ones like at Loch na Gar, where that doesn't exist nearby. It is just literally the white, broken chalk soils. And so those things are, you know, going to be a lot more stable than the other materials. So Hawthorne, with its collapses in, it's a lot less stark than Loch na Gar. And that is all down to natural processes and degradation. And so it's great to see people actually taking an interest.
And is it the kind of, I mean, I'm not a geologist, of course, but is it the kind of to do with the way the chalk seam kind of sits on that landscape, the way that some areas have got more of that reddish soil that you talk about and Loch na Gar hasn't?
Yeah, it is all down to a sort of obscure piece of geology that relates really to the creation of the Alps. I know this is way outside of the area of this, well, not too far away if you're getting down towards, you know, the Vosges and other places. And what happened during that sort of, you know, millennia, millions of years past, is that once that those mountains were created, so the area of France and southern England was flexed. So you've got a like corrugated form to it. And that's why you've got the London Basin and Hampshire and the Weald and so on, which, of course, was very evocative for those soldiers from that part of the world who went to the Somme. I'm a northerner. The chalk to me when I came down to London was, what is this? So from the northwest, northeast, yeah, you'll know to chalk. Northwest, no. So it's always struck me as an alien thing. But for those men from, you know, from the Weald of Kent, from Hampshire, from Sussex and so on, it would have been very familiar with this rolling downland, which is created by this sort of flexure created by, you know, geological millennia. And what you then have is a set of soils on top of it created by the Ice Age. So what we're seeing here is during the Ice Age, with the ice moving across the surface, it scrapes it all away, but also it lays down sort of clay as the ice moves on. It kind of leaves a muddy stain on the landscape. So some parts it's scraped away and other parts it's left a muddy stain. And then finally on top of that, there's something called loess. Loess is a very, very fine material. Brick earth, it's called in Kent. And so what we're seeing there is that this fine material, this less. Mix that with a bit of water. It all gets all mixed up into something which you don't want to. You're going to have to spend a lot of time scraping off your boots. That classic picture of the officer, I think it's Bean, isn't it, in the trenches there, with up to his waist in this stuff. So it is just by a sort of accident of geography that some of them have it and some of them don't. And what's really important is, of course, the miners themselves were tunneling at depth. One thing that's kind of crazy, and you think about it, and this is the level of sophistication that the engineers were getting to on all sides. I mean, they had engineers who were obviously looking for water in and around the Somme. Water isn't really very present at the surface. You get it in the rivers, but you don't get anywhere else. That's where you get these sort of dry, rolling valleys. So they had to look for water by drilling holes, just as they do in London and, you know, in the southeast. And so what's really fascinating is that at depth, they knew the level to which the water saturated the ground. So that meant that anybody who was tunneling had to tunnel between the surface and the saturated ground, and it varied according to winter, and it got very complicated. So you've got all these guys who are thinking, right, I'm going to dig myself a tunnel. I need to make sure it's at a certain depth, and I need to make sure that it's going to be packed with a certain amount of explosives. And what I found in the research I've been doing with my colleagues from Kiel and others is that if you look at the mining manuals from the time, we tend to think, or it has been a sense, that we went unprepared and we had no idea. This is just not true. What happened was, it's kind of like these manuals were on the shelves. The British Royal Engineers had done a set of exercises in chalk in and around Chatham back in the sort of latter part of the 19th century and into the early 20th. So they knew what was going to happen and when they exploded stuff. They did it kind of live firing. And so surprisingly, you know, a few of these things were destroyed, you know, destroyed the landscape. Surprisingly, some of them probably not really very well present, but ultimately they knew what was going to happen. So they took these manuals down and they started to use very complex engineering formulae. And so I've had to think, right, can I deconstruct this? So I know the depth, I know the volume of the charge, I know what happened in terms of the crater. Can I reconstruct it to know whether or not this was, you know, working according to their plan? And I think what's emerged from this is, this was the first time that they'd really exploded something of this size. So classic kind of, well, let's just pack it with explosive. Let's try and apply these statistical formulae and let's hope that it blows up. And what they were trying to do was, the phrase is overcharge the mine. Overcharging the mine means you pack it with loads of explosive and the thing blasts out and you create a crater. If you undercharge it, then the likelihood is you're going to have what's known as a camouflage. That means you destroy the workings underground and you don't break the surface. And so it's a delicate balance between that. What I found using this is that the only one that was super overcharged, can you guess which one? Loch na Garr. So that's the one. And that's why that's such a big hole in the ground. That is four times the norm. And it's what's known as a four-lane crater. It's massive. The other ones, they were rather called common mines, which means kind of like a crater, but not so much. So it really was Loch na Garr. So I guess when they pushed those plungers, they were thinking, let's hope we get this crater. And when they saw Loch na Garr, they think, wow. And that comes out in everybody who visited that, you know, during the war. And, you know, when we see war artists going there and they're being, you know, Orpen, for example, describing it, this sort of great wound. He found, I think there's some famous descriptions of it. There's a kind of mound at the bottom of Loch na Garr, which had skulls and stuff on it, you know, really gruesome. And it really, to him, kind of conjured up, like you said, conjured up this image of the destroyed landscape. I think what has been described as murdered nature there by other authors. And I think this is really classic. So it was really fascinating to try and do that as a sort of thought exercise. It got me involved in some mathematical formulae that I probably didn't need to do, but it was really fascinating to see where their minds were going in terms of exploding these incredible works of human endeavor. incredible pieces of engineering and also incredible destruction.
And I guess this kind of mirrors the development of the tunnelling companies of the Royal Engineers and the work that they were doing, because they essentially start off in what was the main British sector, didn't they, which is Flanders and yes. Northern France, which is different geology to the Somme. And once that sector is taken over by the British, they're operating in a different environment in that troglodyte world beneath the Western Front. So I guess they're developing these new ways of doing it, and by kind of supercharging these mines, I guess that's making sure that these big attacks are at least partly successful, or hopefully wholly successful, following the explosion of these mines and all the thousands, tens of thousands of man hours that must have gone into it.
No, you're absolutely right, Paul. I think what we're seeing here, because I think for the most part, people view the Somme through the lens of the first day of the Battle of the Somme, and that does often irritate and anger almost a number of military historians who spent their lives considering this. I can't get over the fact that the first day in the Battle of the Somme was the way it was. It takes a lot of processing. And as part of that, and that's why I really concentrated with my colleagues on the mine craters of the first day of the Battle of the Somme. What was their purpose? Well, the purpose of them was to do exactly as you say, was to bring some of the expertise further south. It's using the expertise of mining engineers. These are men who have been across the empire, have worked in a variety of different mine situations, and they're coming to use their engineering expertise. And as you again know, there are a number of the men who are working underground there. Probably you would not want them to hold a rifle, but you definitely would trust them to hold a pick. And I think, it's really interesting to see how they applied their minds to this. And what they're trying to do is they're trying to counter the German doctrine of Stellungsbau. Stellungsbau is the fortress construction. And I think getting my head around this is really about understanding just how the Germans created a fortress, because we are seeing a mutual siege. And that mutual siege is, held as two lines. But the Germans, of course, had mastery of that because they had captured the high ground. In most cases, they had selected where they were going to dig their trenches. And they had no reticence about creating the western boundary of their, in fact, their war. So that's what they were doing. They were creating something to hold off the Allies whilst they defeated the Russians in the east. So hardly surprising, they're going to bring all of their engineering skill, and they're going to make sure that it combines their skill so that they have combined fields of fire, they have defense in depth, have the capability of protecting their men at depth in these deep dugouts. I mean, you'll know this very well, as will many of it listeners. There's almost a sort of, how dare the Germans, how the dastardly Germans for digging deep, deep, deep dugouts, and how terrible that was. Well, what else are they going to do? I mean, why wouldn't they do that? It's a different imperative for the British and French. Of course, they're trying to attack, and they're trying not to sit there in these trenches, but the Germans are holding it. And you can't help drawing parallels between that and the terrible Ukraine war right now, as you see this unfolding right in front of us. The Germans have created a fortress. And so what they're trying to do to combat Stellungsbau is to dig tunnels underneath the strongest German fortresses in that. So, like the Scharbner Redoubt, for example, which didn't have a mine under it, but the Wunderwerk and other things. They had many, many different of the elements of this in their Stellungsbau. And of course, they were took over from the French when they arrived, May or maybe earlier, and to try and to pick through this and to dig these. So they were taking over a lot of the French action. So they didn't have a hugely coordinated campaign. They didn't take out every piece of the front line. That would rest with another mine war in another part of the front line, in, of course, 7th of June 1917, and the Battle of Messines, when they did coordinate it and where they did have every single one of those fortresses exploded by mines. Here you have them wherever they could. They tried to make up for it by having these what's known as Russian saps, which were shallow tunnels, which they would break out and allow the men to emerge, but nobody told the men and nobody told the commanders on the ground. And so this was largely wasted. So they were going to have, you know, these exploding mines, and they were going to have these other saps. And then it came down to the commanders on the ground. They'd not seen things this size. So Hunter Weston, of course, had seen mines going off in Gallipoli, where there was a mine warfare there, and he had experienced it, you know, and understood what was going on in the north, where there were this sort of cat and mouse trying to explode these mines. Here, this is something different. You know, these are going to be huge mines, overcharged. We know about Loch Nagar. And what was going to happen was, as the mine exploded, it's going to create this huge fountain of earth and stone. And I think one of the things that is probably the most significant thing that I've drawn out in the paper that we were putting together on this is, if you think about it, one of the most important cultural artifacts from the Somme with us today is the film, The Battle of the Somme. And in that, the explosion of Hawthorne as it goes up. And you can see it as it goes up. And so, you know, you can see all of those things falling down. And what Hunter Weston and others were engaged in and worried about was, of course, what was going to happen when this thing blew up. And so there was a huge tussle. Lots of people like Simon Jones and others have worked on this to try and unpick, and including also the official historian, unpick why they exploded this 10 minutes before zero. And what they were trying to do was to reduce the casualties of the British as they were moving forward into this rain of soil and stones. And they were also trying to perhaps create a surprise element. What it did, of course, as we know, create an absolute disaster. Is it one of the critical things about mine warfare is that you're not only going to have a hole in the ground, you're going to have a ridge, what's known as a radius of destruction. It's a ridge going around it, which creates higher ground. And so the British were absolutely abysmal at capturing craters for a variety of reasons. The Germans always seem to get there first. And it's that that happened, of course, at Hawthorne. Hawthorne and what the work that was done there archaeologically with the Hawthorne Ridge Crater Association and the work that I was in with my colleagues shows how the Germans fortified the ridge of the crater. There are actually the classic fire bays and stuff that you can pick out in that crater rim. So, you know, they captured that quite clearly. So I think, again, it's down to the reticence of the Germans. If you look at the Tambre and also, you know, Casino Point and all those, there you're in a different part of the sector. We know how that's been more successful in the 18th Division. And there, of course, you've got men in no man's land ready to go. There were casualties from falling rocks, but probably what they had discovered by once Hawthorne went up is that once it went up, it came down pretty quickly, straight down. And I think, although if you were in no man's land and you were ready to go, as these guys were, yes, there were some casualties, but they were able to get out there and to do their job. So all of that was learned on the Somme. So it didn't have craters or mines so close together that it would do the same as Messines, but it taught them what to do. And they knew surely that they couldn't leave this sort of gap. They had to blow it all together, and they had to coordinate with artillery and the infantry assault. So it really was an important learning experience.
And when we kind of think of the Somme, we often can use the word big about the Somme. You know, it was a huge endeavour to assemble the biggest British army at that point to make an attack along that Somme front. Huge amount of artillery. The evidence that you see in the film that you mentioned, you know, that they push that point home with the amount of shells stockpiled for the bombardment, indicating that the work of civilians had been achieved and was contributing towards the kind of outcome of the battle. And it was called the big push, and the mines were going to be big. But there was this faith, wasn't there, in the bombardment and then the mines and the sheer weight of numbers, that it would result in this cakewalk, this easy battle that, of course, it wasn't. It was quite the opposite. And do you think all of those, and particularly perhaps the mines as well, are kind of part of that misplaced faith in the power that they had, because they hadn't really refined it at that point?
I think there's a bit of a point in that. And you look back to the Battle of Loos, and you know there that the faith that was placed in gas, as an example. And what's happening here is, obviously Douglas Haig, that's a name that's going to conjure up immediately people's, you know, views one side or the other. All I can tell you is that one person that I was researching relatively recently, associated with another project that I'm doing, his name, middle name, was Douglas Haig. He was killed, in the Second World War, 1940, beg your pardon. And so this guy had been named after this general, and lost his life near Bray Dunes, which, you know, it's important for me to see. But when we go back to this, we're thinking about Haig in the Battle of Loos, and his faith was placed in the new piece of technology, which is gas warfare. And of course, that was to make up for the inadequacy of the shells, and, you know, was a new weapon of war that could be deployed. As we know, it was mixed success. Same on the Somme, there's mixed success. So we tend to sweep a hand and say, this part, you know, this whole thing was a complete disaster. The gas was a complete disaster. No, it wasn't. It just was all down to more complex things than they imagined. So everybody talks about the gas and it's going to be wind. Right now, I've got a PhD student working on this. It's not just about wind. It's about the flow of gas over the landscape. And so I think people just didn't know what was going to happen at the time. It's the same if you go to the Somme. What's happening in the Somme now? We have the opportunity of having massed artillery, which didn't have before. Everybody knows about the scandals to do with the shells not exploding, you know, and the manufacturing faults and those brought from America and so on and so forth may or may not have contributed towards that. There's also a lot of discussion about Kitchener's army and the fact they were untrained. Well, that's just not true. They were trained. Absolutely. They were in training for a year. So these guys were trained. Whether or not they were battle-hardened and capable of taking what was asked of them is a different matter. But definitely they were trained soldiers. There's no doubt about that. And the way in which it was organized, so that they were leavened by, you know, the territorials and regulars as well. So that's certainly, you know, again, a bit of a misnomer. And when it comes down to the mines, as I said, there was little choice. They couldn't. It wasn't like Messines where they had a 2 years or so for some of those mines to get them ready. This was, you know, months. This was a huge amount of work. If they'd have had more time and more capability, they probably could have taken out all of these different ones. You know, they use the flame projector, as you know, that in Mamet's way. You know, there's a number of different technologies being used there. And a lot of that faith was invested in that. It's a bit like, I don't know, I'm a big polar explorer kind of a guy interested in that. And there's a classic film, of course, which is all about Captain Scott of the Antarctic. And it's a classic point there when Scott is talking to Nansen, who was a really famous Norwegian explorer. Nansen says, I would take dogs, and that's all I would do. I'd take dogs, and those dogs would get me to the pole. And Scott says, I will take dogs, I will take ponies, I will take tractors, and because I want to try out the new technology. All of those failed. The dogs would have taken him. So I think, again, it's this investment in technology, the capability, the faith that maybe that would do the job. And maybe when it came down to it, it was the individual commanders on the ground, as we know, Maxey and so on, get them into no man's land, get them ready to go, because it was crossing no man's land that was that did for them. And certainly that was the case at Sir. And I think it's just, it's great for us to sit there and go, well, yeah, they should have done this and should have done that. But this is all new to them, absolutely new. And I think when we look at the Somme, we do have to look at it as in its entirety. I can't get my head around the first day. I still can't. And I think that's something that we will reflect on forever. But you will then go on to see the use of tanks and the use of, you know, more considered approaches, taking pieces of it. But those ones that didn't fall never fell in that first day. And I think when you look at that and you relate those to the craters, mine craters, did it make any difference? Well, Loch Nagar, they got there, but, you know, didn't manage to capture it. Hawthorne didn't get there. It's only when we see how it combines with some of the other the general's expectations. You know, the Tamba, of course, was not there to be assaulted. It was just there to, you know, shake the Germans up. But when you go down to Casino Point, you do get to see that actually that had an impact. So again, it's just learning. But the scale of the loss is something that is so shocking, and really is. And the first time, or the first time for years, I've been to Free Corps cemetery and stood in that cemetery while seeing those, that cratered landscape, and seeing all those 1st of July casualties in there, it just takes your breath away. You can't underestimate that. You can't.
No, I mean, the kind of Battle of the Somme is a seismic shift, to kind of excuse the pun, in terms of this podcast, but not just in kind of warfare and the way that warfare was conducted, moving it really from a, you know, an old way of warfare to a new one, with industry being kind of at the heart of it to produce everything that was needed to kill people on this industrial scale. But I guess as well, it kind of showed that the war could not be won without the kind of methods that they were already beginning to employ, with the increased use of bombardments, artillery, tunneling, and as you mentioned, tanks being developed and ready for kind of partway through the Somme, and our aircraft in the sky above, and the whole kind of development of a modern battle. And we kind of forget really that this is only partway into the war, and there's another more than two years to go before its conclusion. And sometimes I often think it's a miracle that it did finish in that time, really, when you kind of see the size and scale of the Western Front. But I guess from the mines point of view, with kind of supercharging Lochmagar, this was all lessons that went on to be then applied.
Oh yeah.
For the most famous tunneling episode, which is back in Flanders again the following year.
Absolutely. And I think it is all about the idea of the technology and the scientists and technologists who are working on this. Because, as you rightly say, it shifts from the gentleman's war and it goes into this war of science and technology. And so logistics really matter. The military-industrial complex, in other words, the people at home creating those weapons. I think it was Nick Saunders who first pointed out that there's a strange circularity to the fact that if you think about trench art, you know, things made out of shells, that you might be finding that the men and women who made the shells so that their loved ones could fire the shells, so that their bodies could be wounded by those shells, and then they would bring back from the battlefield a piece of a shell to display on their shelf. There's a sort of weird circularity to it. So this is indicative of this kind of, you know, idea of the creation of this science. And I think I'm not a massive fan of the most recent film on All Quiet on the Western Front, but I think, again, which is something like a modern horror, I guess. But in what that does demonstrate is this idea of the horror of this new technology of tanks and flamethrowers and all the rest of that. And so all of that is being created. If you can get all of those big minds together, if you get all of those people and specialists like that we've discussed in this podcast so far, then you're going to have, and you have a general like Plumer, who's going to be methodical, careful, and plan it to a degree. It may look like, you know, sort of Colonel Blimp character, but that guy knew what he was doing. And I think he was able to construct the idea of this earthquaking the ridge, which, of course, Norton Griffiths and other, you know, entrepreneurs, if you like, were saying, let's get this done. Let's get the tunneling companies together. There's a huge interest in tunneling companies right now, and, you know, rightly so. But what's happening here there is they're starting to understand everything from the very specific layers in the ground right the way through to the fact of the charges. You say, how would these be overcharged? Completely different ways of dealing with it, because it's all a balance between the amount of explosive, the depth of the ground of the tunnel, and the amount and the different types of soil and rock that you have to blow your way through. And I think it's they had geologists, they had mining engineers, they had specialists in every aspect of this, and they had to deal with other things. One of the things about disposing the spoil is important, because I think you've alluded to this. this is a battle now. This is a war space, which is not just on the horizontal. It's on a vertical, and it's on the vertical that goes below the ground and into the air. So, you know, your Red Baron and guys at the top, they're not just flying around in their fancy aeroplanes to, you know, to pick off other people in fancy aeroplanes. They're there to pick off the men who flew the observation aeroplanes, who could see what was going on and make those make out those mines and consider the kind of things like construction of aerial photographs and maps. They were there. It was a simple brutality to knock those guys out of the sky. That's what those fellows were there for. So the Red Baron, Ron Richthofen, did a damn good job for his nation, because that's what he was intending to do. Not about knocking down the flyboys, but about getting these things. And that's as much part of, as you go down through that vertical, as much part of that as you get down to those men who are observing, you know, the forward observation officers for the artillerymen, the engineers, everybody else. And then as you go subsurface, it's still a cat and mouse game. So you might have your Red Baron and your, you know, Mick Manock in the air above, but you're going to have your, you know, the people underground that were willing to fight it out with your knives, clubs, and whatever else. And it's all part of this technological battle. Who is going to get the upper hand? Better machines in the air, better technology, understanding underground. And it's no sort of jingoistic viewpoint, but the British had really encapsulated that in Flanders. The Germans in Flanders had the high ground. They were able to look down on this, and they had constructed the Stellungsbau, this construction of a fortress, by having concrete, by combating the waterlogged ground. But it meant that as soon as they dug anything down, there was a fountain of water. There's a classic picture, vignette, if you like, of a Prussian officer beautifully uniformed with a great fountain of, you know, dirt coming out of him as he looked over. The ordinary soldiers probably thought that was highly amusing. But the British, what they were, and Canadians and Australians and New Zealanders and many other nations who were tunneling, they had to tunnel down a little way, tunnel horizontally, and then blow the Germans up. So the topographical advantage of the Germans was nullified by the geological advantage, that is the layers that the British could mine into, which didn't have all of this water welling up in it, that they could get into the clay, the blue clay. Now, as I said, you've got this vertical surface. So your Red Baron, who's trying to knock down the observer, the observers are trying to see, are they tunneling? And if they're tunneling on the sun, they're going to see some white stuff everywhere. If they are tunneling in Flanders, they'll be in the clay layer, which I think most people refer to as blue clay. It is a peculiar green, gray, blue, down to the clay minerals, and they won't bore you with the specifics of that. But that material is bright blue green when you bring it out. It soon oxidizes to a kind of muddy clay. But you get that out, you put that in sandbags, they're going to see it from above. And that's what those guys are beetling around up there trying to do. Are they digging that? Because in this space between the guys above and the guys below, there's the PBI stuck in the middle, who are stuck between the engineers at one point and the artillerymen on the other, and the airmen in front and the tunnels beneath the ground. There's right in that middle, and it all depends on those boots on the ground. And so on the Battle of the Somme, you know, we know what happened. Those guys went over the top, and we constantly try and understand that. At Messines, they got it right. They had more mines planned. They had more mines laid. They were going to take out every single strong point along that, and they were going to coordinate that with artillery fire and also the infantry assault. And that's why it was such a success. They got it right in doing that. And I think it is all about coordination. I mentioned about the Ukraine war and how the coordination of the Russians currently to create these sort of lines of defense, and the same, you could see that in Normandy. You can look at the difference between Omaha and Sword, and you can see a completely different topographical advantage, and you can draw parallels directly with Gallipoli. So it was all down to understanding that this technologists, scientists, people who know what they're doing, can advise those men whose boots are on the ground and who have to go and do that terrible job that they have to, which is go over the top.
Yeah, I mean, I think you kind of rightly describe a kind of multi-layered war there. And I think, you know, probably for many people listening to this, that is all part of the fascination of it, is that it is such a complex kind of battle space, the battle space of the First World War, with men underground, men on the surface, men above the battlefield. And you get up to the kind of northern end of the Western Front, and you've got that kind of left flank at sea with naval forces operating there. So you've got that element to it as well. And I mean, so much really. But kind of Messines, as we said, learning from the experience on the Somme, Messines becomes kind of finest hour of the tunnelers, but in many ways their final hour, because the war becomes far more mobile and then ends with the armistice. And then the landscape of the Great War that's left once that fighting is over, because they include many of these craters, and I guess they take on a different significance then.
Yeah, they do. And I think what you see then is this question of memorialization. So, you know, you probably know more about the background of why and how Loch Nagar was obtained, but thank goodness it was, as we've already discussed, Wysap, which is a similar kind of size crater, again, near Le Boisselle. So, was lost, filled in, because people are coming back to their landscapes. They want their lives to come back, and they think, right, well, let's fill this up and get on with the job. So, you know, I think it really is about memorializing. There is a famous, the Pool of Peace, of course, Banbuk Molan, in which is part of the Messines Ridge craters. And again, you go to that and it's kind of, you know, low and filled with water, reeds and lilies and the rest of it. And yeah, it's kind of peaceful. Difficult in many ways to perceive how that was a huge mine. And there are others that are lost. It is fascinating. If you go to the Caterpillar Crater, which of course is part of the Hill 60 sort of complex on either side of that railway line, and just by fate, again, it's all down to groundwater that is filling that crater. It's not down to rain necessarily, with groundwater, it's going to keep bubbling up, it's going to keep filling that crater. And I think it's really interesting to see that itself was preserved, as because the forest grew around it, that Hill 60 was preserved because, of course, the site of Endeavour, huge numbers of men lost their lives there, huge amounts of tunneling effort, you know, mining and counter mining through many years of activity. But you look at others, you know, and they've been and gone. And I think it's just by kind of fate. And one of the great things, I guess, is that there's now an increasing interest in the preservation and conservation of these battle sites. Since before the centenary and during, of course, there was an idea of an audit, certainly in Flanders, to try and find out every single thing that might relate to that battlefield. And that really came about following the fact that there was a plan to extend the motorway, the A19, from Zonnebeke to past Ypres up to the coast. And fortunately, there were enough people in Belgium who were able to get involved in that, consider what was going to happen, and through the all-party group, which I'm secretary of, the colleagues there were able to say, hold on, let's stop for a minute, let's think about this. And what happened was the creation of a Flanders Institute, which looked away from Roman remains and things which were deemed to be old, to battlefield archaeology. And so our great friend Simon Verdigan, who we've worked with and admire, of course, for the work that he's done, his work and his forebears and people that come after him are all down to the fact that there was a change in expectation, that suddenly the First World War was an important thing. And it's only a pity that the chance that I think the Flanders authorities had to try and get this as a World Heritage Site, they put every effort into that, and yet those were not accepted because there was some concern over it being a military historical setting. I hope that would be turned around, because we really do need to think about the future generations, because it's so easy for those craters to be lost. Because again, if you look at Spang McMolan, you could imagine that just silting up over the years and being lost. And certainly the same in a number of the other craters, smaller ones, in and around the landscape. And a question is always, how do you value that? What makes that more important than this? And that is the big conservation question, always.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're right with Spanbrook Molen. I mean, even in my kind of lifetime of visiting it, it kind of feels, and maybe this is not a bad thing really, but kind of feels as if nature's taking it back. It's becoming more and more overhung, and the kind of, I think the nature of the water that's in there looks different to me to kind of what I remember from the past. There doesn't seem to be as many people fishing in it anymore as there once was, for example. I guess that possibly says something. But yeah, it's an interesting one. I mean, I guess these mine craters have come to, as we said at the beginning, kind of characterise the First World War, symbolise it, because of the nature of smashed landscape and this kind of alien world that the landscape of the Western Front became. And you mentioned Orpin and the idea of kind of a scar and a wound that these craters were. And I guess perhaps many pilgrims who travelled to those battlefields in the interwar period, having lost somebody, kind of maybe felt they were almost looking into the depths of hell when they stood on the edge of those craters.
I think that's absolutely right. And particularly because it is certainly the violence of this. Bear in mind, of course, Loch Nahara, as you well know, is two mines. So that's why it explodes outwards like a fountain, whereas obviously Hawthorne went straight up and straight down because it was one. And because of the lack of the soil, which you get at Hawthorne, it's kind of mucky soil, and now you've got something where you can see the rabbits running in and out of the chalky burrows and stuff. You can see that it is chalk. So it must have been really stark. It certainly was stark when Masefield went there in, you know, 1917, and Orpin, you know, obviously your podcast, The Old Front Line, and Masefield's writing is just incredible, because again, really shows it. I've only just come across Masefield's actual diaries that were published some years back, and again they're very stark in terms of what he's seeing in front of it. And so these are poets and artists, and they're picking out this stark landscape. And what must it have felt for those pilgrims, the early ones, of course, possibly being, you know, men or women and children who had lost their sons, their brothers, their husbands, their fathers, and so on. And so to go to this landscape and to see this scattered as it would be with, you know, scrap metal. I mean, the first time I went some years back now to the landscape of the Somme and of also Hill 60, there was scrap metal everywhere. You know, it was just lying around, obviously a real health hazard. But I think it must have been incredible to have seen that, and what you must have thought. Maybe they felt that if, you know, my father, son, husband faced this, how terrible it must have been. Maybe it was something that they never forgot, and maybe it was something that they may have had great concerns over or upset when they saw it. Or maybe they thought, well, you know, he did his peace. He lies at peace in the beautiful fields of the Somme. And as you rightly say, everything is huge on the Somme, and the skies on the Somme are just the best. I mean, those men lie under that beautiful azure blue sky, and you think, wow, how could human beings do this in this amazing landscape and to each other? It's a horrific thing. And that's what happens in war. And so bigger and bigger holes in the ground, bigger and bigger weapons of destruction. And that's what you're going to have, the PBI in the middle and those people who mourn them when they fall.
And I guess that, you know, kind of like symbols of an ancient civilization, the craters come to kind of stand for what that war was about. And generations, you know, way into the future will stand there just as we've both taken people to the edge of these craters, and they kind of look at these things and they can't really believe that it's even possible. You know, 1,000 years from now, you'd like to think that people will still be doing that. And you've mentioned Ukraine a couple of times. I guess there's a resonance there as well, that kind of history is repeating itself, and that once this war is over and Ukraine is victorious, which we all want, then there will be people standing on those battlefields having exactly the same kind of emotions as those pilgrims that we often spoken about and written about and discussed and seen in the kind of faded images. There'll be the same thing now.
Absolutely the case. And I think I talked earlier about the engineers taking those manuals off the shelves and reopening them. That's happening right now. So although not as far as I'm aware in the Ukraine war, but certainly in the Middle East. And just a few weeks ago, there was what they call a tunnel bomb. In other words, one of these mines, which was exploded and created craters. There was a casino, I think, hotel also some years back now, and maybe 2016, something like that. Again, there'd been evidence of underground work, of tunneling. This is going on right now. And these people are using, you know, the actors in this are using explosives as simple as fertilizer and are creating the same kind of activities. So the idea of mine warfare having reached its apogee, you know, in the, you know, the battle of the machines, which took a lot of planning and organization. Well, that's happening right now also. And so there's no doubt that this is likely to happen again. And they're going to take those manuals down. They're going to reapply them. And they're definitely going to be at some point in the future standing on the rim of those craters and imagining what it must have been like, or trying to imagine what it must have been like. And also, you know, pondering on the fact that why do we as human beings do this to each other? It's incredible to see.
I guess once again, we kind of prove to ourselves that the Great War never exists in isolation. It's kind of, it's always part of a wider story, part of a past, part of a present, part of a future.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah.
Well, Peter, I mean, it's as always, it's absolutely fascinating talking to you about these kind of subjects. You've always got so much to give and so much to tell us. So it's a real, real, real pleasure. I don't know if this is something you're going to be kind of writing about in the future, or what you're working on at the moment from a writing point of view, but maybe it's a secret.
No, not at all. So I have a paper to that conference. I have an article that is in with them being reviewed right now. But I really want to sort of take that a little bit on and look again at this kind of landscape issue. So yeah, you can assume that I'll be looking at that. But right now I'm working on a different war, the Boer War, and I'm looking at Queen Victoria's chocolate tin to match Princess Mary's cigarettes. So yeah, watch this space for that.
Well, I look forward to that because I've had one of those tucked away for many a year, and your book on the Princess Mary is an absolutely fantastic book that kind of told us so much about, you know, something that we probably thought we knew a lot about, but actually your book proved that we didn't. So it's I look forward to that. I mean, your books are always fantastically researched, beautifully produced, stunning kind of images. The way you present artifacts really is quite something, Peter. So I look forward to that greatly.
Thank you very much. That's, yeah, I'm very pleased to hear that. I do spend a lot of time with that. It's really important. Do we understand that these objects are mute witness to these wars? And if we can understand what they're trying to tell us, we'll then have a broader understanding of the war itself. And I think the Great War, with its cultural resonance today, its significance in many areas, I think, you know, it behoves us to try and understand what they're trying to tell us.
Absolutely. Well, thanks again, Peter. It's always great to talk to you, and thanks for joining us.
Lovely to see you, and thank you for having me.
Cheers, Peter.
You've been listening to an episode of The Old Frontline with me, military historian Paul Reed. You can follow me on Twitter at SomCorps. You can follow the podcast at Old Frontline Pod. Check out the website at oldfrontline.co.uk, where you'll find lots of podcast extras and photographs and links to books that are mentioned in the podcast. And if you feel like supporting us, you can go to our Patreon page, patreon.com/oldfrontline, or support us on Buy Me a Coffee at buymeacoffee.com/oldfrontline. Links to all of these are on our website. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you again soon.